So imagine you wake up the morning after a Category 5 hurricane.
Oh, wow. Yeah, total nightmare scenario.
Right. You step outside and the destruction is just, I mean, it's absolute.
Everything is just flattened.
Exactly. Like the roof of the local hospital has been sheared completely off.
Oh, dang.
Power lines are sparking in these flooded, debris-filled streets. The municipal water pumps have failed. Crops are ruined. And the commercial port is just, functionally destroyed.
Right, it's the textbook definition of a crisis.
It really is. And naturally, the elected government steps in.
As they should.
Right. They declare a state of emergency. They marshal the National Guard. And they promise to clear the roads, rebuild the schools, keep the food supply moving.
Yeah, and it feels completely morally unambiguous.
Absolutely. The government is in charge. They have the constitutional mandate to protect their citizens, and they are, they're going to fix it.
Because that is the baseline expectation of a modern citizen, right?
Yep.
We operate under this assumption that the state possesses both the legal authority and the functional sovereignty to act when survival is on the line.
Right. But here is the central question we're exploring today on this deep dive. Who is actually in control of that recovery?
That is the million-dollar question.
Is it the politicians you just saw giving a press conference? Or is it a distant, deeply embedded network of bondholders, rating agencies, and foreign commercial banks?
Yeah, the invisible architecture.
Exactly. Today, our mission is to dig into a truly groundbreaking 2026 paper by Dr. Bechara Sahili. It's titled The Sovereignty of Credit.
It's such a fascinating piece of work.
It really is. We are going to unpack the hidden, credit constitution that quietly governs our lives, because this dictates everything from how a devastated city gets rebuilt to whether you, the listener, can ever afford to buy a house in your own neighborhood.
Yeah, and what Dr. Sahili has done here is synthesize this massive amount of transdisciplinary research.
Oh, it pulls from everywhere.
It really does.
Mm.
I mean, the source material pulls from monetary history, political economy, public health, even ecological systems theory.
Wow, so it's not just a finance paper.
Not at all. It presents finance not as this neutral mechanism for moving money, but as a form of absolute structural power over the future of human life.
That is heavy.
Yeah, it requires us to fundamentally rethink what actually governs our reality.
And, whether you are currently paying off a 30-year mortgage, relying on public infrastructure to commute, or just trying to wrap your head around why the global economy often feels so disconnected from human needs, this deep dive is going to reveal the strings pulling behind the curtain.
It's all connected.
It is. Okay, let's unpack this. Let's stay with that small island nation the morning after the hurricane.
Okay, setting the scene.
Right. The physical storm has passed. Now, the financial storm begins. What is the immediate, mechanical reality hitting that government?
Well, the immediate reality is this brutal mathematical collision.
A collision of what?
So, in the prologue of the paper, the island state hits a financial wall the very second the winds die down.
Really? That fast?
Oh, yeah. Think about the mechanics of disaster economics. Domestic tax revenues plummet to near zero instantly.
Well, sure, because businesses are destroyed and citizens are out of work.
Exactly. And this happens at the exact millisecond that public spending must exponentially increase to save lives and clear debris.
So income goes to zero, expenses go through the roof.
Right. Plus, to rebuild, this island needs to import physical goods. They need diesel generators, antibiotics, steel, food.
And they can't just buy that with their local currency.
No, they have to purchase those imports using foreign currencies,
Yeah.
like US dollars or euros, which they do not print and, cannot magically summon.
So they're entirely dependent on foreign reserves. They can't just mandate their central bank to print local currency to buy foreign steel because the foreign steel producer doesn't want their local money.
Exactly. It's essentially worthless outside the island's borders in that context.
Wow. Which means the elected cabinet, despite their constitutional authority, is paralyzed.
Completely paralyzed. And this is where the true governors of the recovery step into the light.
The shadow governors.
Yeah, the paper points out that the politicians suddenly find themselves answering to commercial banks.
And what are the banks doing?
Well, the banks immediately tighten lending to protect their own liquidity ratios.
To self-preservation.
Right. And then they have to answer to foreign correspondent banks that control the international payment rails.
Like the digital plumbing.
Yes, and those banks can decide to delay or freeze transactions to investigate risk.
While people are waiting for antibiotics.
Exactly. Then you have sovereign rating agencies sitting in office buildings thousands of miles away who might look at the hurricane damage and just mathematically downgrade the island's credit rating.
Which instantly spikes their borrowing costs.
Yes, it makes it vastly more expensive to get the money they desperately need. And all the while, existing foreign creditors are demanding that their scheduled debt service payments be met.
Like, hey, I know you're underwater, but you owe us this month's payment.
Right, regardless of the physical reality on the ground.
So we often hear this described simply as a lack of resources. Like, if you don't have the money, you don't have the money.
Right, the conventional wisdom.
But the paper calls this dynamic a constitution. And I'm struggling with that word choice a bit.
Why is that?
Well, when I think of a constitution, I think of a piece of paper with signatures that establishes a parliament and a Supreme Court, you know, rights and laws. Why elevate financial constraints to the level of a constitution?
It's a great question. If we connect this to the bigger picture, Dr. Soulfully is making a really profound structural argument here.
Okay, lay it on me.
He's saying that beneath the visible political constitution, you know, the one granting voting rights and establishing legislatures, there lies this deeper credit constitution.
And what's in that constitution?
It's comprised of property laws, collateral registries, international accounting standards, and payment networks.
So the financial infrastructure itself.
Yes. These mechanisms collectively determine whose promises actually count in society.
Whose promises count? That's an interesting way to phrase it.
It is a constitution because it doesn't just passively evaluate risk,
yeah,
right? It makes a sovereign, legally binding judgment about which possible worlds are permitted to acquire purchasing power and materialize.
Oh, I see. So if we think about it like a computer.
Okay, I like where this is going.
The political constitution is just like the software applications running on the desktop. The voters can choose to open the healthcare app or the infrastructure app.
Right, the things we vote on.
But the credit constitution is the underlying operating system. It sits underneath everything, quietly managing the battery power and the memory.
That is a highly accurate analogy.
And so if the operating system decides the healthcare app uses too much battery, meaning, you know, it doesn't meet the financial metrics for a return on investment, it just throttles the power.
It cuts it off.
The app freezes. The voters keep clicking the icon. The politicians keep promising the app will open, but the operating system has already decided it won't.
Yeah, and what makes that operating system so powerful is that it is entirely indifferent to the moral purpose of the app.
It doesn't care if it's a hospital or a casino.
Not at all. The credit constitution evaluates viability based purely on financial legibility, yield, and risk metrics.
Just numbers.
Exactly. It operates on its own internal logic.
Mm-hmm.
It's a concept the paper hints at as a kind of self-replicating blind machinery.
That's a bit scary.
It is. It doesn't ask, does this island need a hospital to survive? It asks, does the anticipated cash flow from this hospital service the debt structure according to Basel III capital requirements?
Wow. Okay, so if the operating system is making these sovereign decisions about our reality, then the primary line of code it uses to write that reality is the financial claim itself, right?
Yes, the claim is the building block.
Like the loan, the bond, the mortgage.
Exactly.
And according to the text, these financial claims are actually doing something quite bizarre with time.
They really are. The paper argues that you cannot understand the credit constitution without understanding how a financial claim actively governs time.
I want to dig into that because credit is almost universally described as borrowing from the future.
Right. We hear that phrase all the time.
But mechanically, I mean, the future isn't a physical place. You can't send an armored truck to the year 2040 and bring back a vault full of cash to spend today.
No, you can't. And what's fascinating here is that Dr. Saley defines credit not as a bridge to some literal vault of future money, but as organized anticipation.
Organized anticipation. What does that mean in practice?
It performs a highly specific, legally enforced temporal conversion.
Okay, you're going to have to break that down for me.
Sure. The financial system looks at an anticipated future capacity. So, a family's future labor and wages, a government's future ability to extract taxes, or even a forest's future capacity to yield timber.
So, things that haven't happened yet.
Exactly. It takes that expectation and converts it into present-day command over physical resources.
So it's essentially taking a ghost-like reality that hasn't happened yet and translating it into a physical brick or a physical tractor today.
Yes, that's a perfect way to visualize it. And the text breaks this down into three distinct temporal dimensions to show exactly how power shifts during this process.
What's the first dimension?
Dimension one is simply the identification of the anticipated flow.
Like, hey, that guy will probably have a job for the next 30 years.
Right. Then dimension two is bringing that imagined value into the present as purchasing power.
Which is the part everybody loves.
Oh, we celebrate this phase. It was when the mortgage clears and you get the keys to the house, or when the sovereign bond is issued and the new bridge gets built.
It feels like magic. Like we just conjured a bridge out of thin air.
It does feel like magic.
Yeah.
But dimension three is where the power dynamic permanently shifts.
Okay. What happens in dimension three?
The financial claim now demands that the future reorganize itself around the obligations created today.
Ah, here's where it gets really interesting. Because this is the dark side of that time travel, right?
It is.
We focus so much on the magic of building the bridge today, we completely ignore how it occupies the future. And the paper uses a very specific term for this.
Yes. Temporal enclosure.
Temporal enclosure. That phrase really stuck with me.
It is one of the most critical concepts in the whole paper.
It makes me think of the Enclosure Acts in England, you know?
Right.
Where common land was suddenly fenced off and privatized.
That's a great historical parallel.
But here we are fencing off time. We are preemptively assigning the labor of citizens who haven't even been born yet, or the ecological capacity of a river, to service a mathematical claim established decades prior.
Yes, exactly.
We are drastically narrowing the freedom of the future because they will inherit this mathematical straitjacket.
And this raises a massive, important question about consent.
Right, because the future people didn't sign the paperwork.
Exactly. The future generations inheriting this enclosed time did not sign the contract. And this brings us to Dr. Sakaly's concept of the double promise of credit.
The double promise.
Yeah, whenever a financial claim is created, there are two simultaneous promises occurring.
Well, what's the first one?
The first is explicit. The borrower signs a contract promising to repay the lender.
Simple enough. I borrow 10 bucks, I promise to pay you 10 bucks back.
Right. But the second promise is implicit, and it is made by society itself.
But wait. If a private developer takes out a loan from a private bank to build, say, a shopping mall, what does society have to do with it? That's a private contract. Society didn't sign anything.
Society didn't sign the contract, but the bank's entire calculus relies on society implicitly promising to maintain the structural conditions that make repayment possible.
Oh, I see.
A 30-year mortgage is essentially a 30-year gamble. That the state will continue to enforce property rights, that the police will execute an eviction if necessary, that the central bank will prevent the currency from hyperinflating.
And that the local ecology will remain stable enough that the house doesn't, you know, fall into the sea or burn down.
Exactly. The private financial claim is effectively free riding on public stability.
Free riding. Wow.
The bank is assuming that the state and the environment will absorb all the costs of keeping the world predictable. So that their mathematical equation resolves perfectly.
And if the ecology collapses, say, a massive wildfire destroys the whole neighborhood, the financial claim doesn't just forgive itself.
No, it certainly doesn't.
It still demands repayment, forcing the borrower to absorb the shock of that environmental disaster.
Precisely. The claim is utterly dependent on life and social order, yet the accounting mechanisms of the claim rarely price in the cost of maintaining that life and social order.
So if finance is pulling the future into the present and relying on society to enforce it, it means finance isn't just a passive observer in all this.
Not at all.
It's not just sitting around waiting for an entrepreneur to show up with a good idea. It is actively designing the world.
Yes. And to fully understand this world-making power, the source text forces us to confront and dismantle one of the most persistent myths taught in introductory economics.
Oh, are you talking about the loanable funds theory?
I am.
The textbook idea of banking as like a matchmaking service.
Yes, the concept of passive intermediation.
I remember learning this. The idea is that savers put their hard-earned money into a bank vault, and then the bank acts as a middleman, lending that exact pile of savings out to a business or a home buyer.
Right. The idea that the bank is just a conduit.
Exactly. Just taking money from column A and moving it to column B.
Well, the paper explicitly categorizes this as a myth that severely obscures how power actually functions.
So it's just wrong.
Fundamentally wrong. In our modern monetary system, commercial banks are not mere intermediaries of existing money.
Then what are they doing?
When a commercial bank approves the loan, they do not check their vault for someone else's savings. Instead, through the stroke of a keyboard, the bank credits the borrower's account with a newly created deposit.
Wait, they just type it into existence.
They create purchasing power through a simultaneous expansion of their balance sheet. They record a loan asset on one side and a deposit liability on the other.
So new money is literally born at the exact moment the contract is signed.
Yes. And the structural implication of this is massive.
I can imagine.
If banks create purchasing power rather than just shuffling existing savings, it means that in the economy, allocation precedes production.
Allocation precedes production. Can you unpack that?
Sure. Finance does not wait for a productive economy to generate savings and then allocate them. Finance decides exactly where new purchasing power enters the economy.
Oh, right.
And that new purchasing power then commands labor and resources to assemble. It dictates which realities get activated.
So if your project gets the loan, your reality gets activated, you get to build your factory.
Exactly.
If it doesn't get the loan, your project remains a ghost. It never happens.
Right.
But that implies that if I have a project, I have to make it look exactly like what the bank wants to see, or I don't get the money.
This is exactly what the text terms the construction of bankability or financial legibility.
Financial legibility.
Yes. Projects must mutate their fundamental nature to become readable to the financial operating system.
They have to speak the language of the machine.
Right. They need predictable, ring-fenced cash flows, standardized legal contracts, enforceable collateral, and clear exit strategies for investors.
You know, it's like trying to get a sprawling, complex novel published, but the only publisher in town only prints step-by-step cookbooks.
I love that analogy.
Like, you might have written a beautiful poetic narrative about the human condition, but if you want to get published, you have to chop your story up into a list of ingredients.
You have to assign cooking times.
Right. You format it as a recipe. The core essence of what you built has to completely change just to fit the medium that holds the power.
That is exactly what happens. And the paper provides a very tangible example of this mutation.
Yeah.
Using municipal water systems.
Oh, let's trace the mechanics of that.
Okay, imagine a city needs a new water purification and distribution system.
Pretty standard municipal project.
Right. If this is conceived purely as a universal public service, its success metric is public health.
Naturally.
Its goal is delivering clean water to every resident, regardless of income, to prevent disease and foster life.
The goal is just keep people alive and healthy.
Exactly. But if the municipality cannot fund this through taxation, perhaps because their temporal future has already been enclosed by other debts, like we discussed.
Right, they're already tapped out.
They must turn to private finance. And to attract private capital, the water system must become bankable.
It has to become a cookbook.
Exactly. It can no longer just be a public good. It must transform into a special purpose vehicle designed to extract an investable yield.
How does that happen mechanically? Do they just start charging for water?
Yes. They institute strict user fees, often with escalating pricing tiers. They mandate cutoff protocols for non-payment, meaning citizens who can't pay lose access to water.
Which completely undermines the original public health goal.
Totally. They might also defer long-term maintenance that doesn't immediately impact quarterly cash flows.
Just to keep the numbers looking good for the investors.
Right. The physical pipes in the ground might look exactly the same, but the institutional relationship has been radically engineered.
The DNA of the system has changed.
Its primary governing purpose has shifted from public health to servicing the yield expectations of the bondholders.
The cookbook analogy really holds up there. The water system literally had to become a recipe for yield.
It did.
The text also applies this logic to housing, doesn't it? Because when we think of a house, we think of shelter, a place to sleep, raise a family, keep out of the rain. But credit completely reorganizes the DNA of a house, too.
It fundamentally alters the asset. Consider what happens when you introduce expanding, mathematically aggressive mortgage credit into a geographic area with a finite supply of land.
Well, if everyone suddenly has access to $500,000 of credit, they just bid up the price of the exact same three-bedroom house.
The price skyrockets. But more importantly, the societal function of the house mutates.
How so?
Because it is now so expensive and heavily leveraged, it ceases to be merely shelter. It becomes a primary store of wealth for the middle class.
Right. It's an investment vehicle now.
It becomes collateral for secondary loans. Mm-hmm. It gets bundled into residential mortgage-backed securities and traded globally. The home is now a heavily financialized asset.
So credit policy is essentially asset price policy.
Yes. And this has profound world-making effects. When housing operates as a financial security designed to appreciate, cities reorganize themselves entirely around the purchasing power of investors and highly leveraged buyers.
Which pushes out normal people.
Zoning laws are manipulated to protect property values, dense affordable housing is blocked, and young households are pushed further into the geographic margins.
Increasing their commute times, delaying their financial independence.
Right. Finance didn't set out with a master plan to cause a housing crisis or urban sprawl, but the systemic mechanism of credit transforms the very nature of human shelter.
Okay, this world-making power is staggering. It dictates how water is distributed, what a house is used for, who gets to rebuild after a hurricane. But surely this isn't just one monolithic entity.
No, it's not.
There isn't just one guy pulling a giant lever in a bank somewhere. How is this power actually layered in reality?
Dr. Stanley conceptualizes this by mapping out what he calls the financial power stack.
The financial power stack?
Yes. It is a framework showing that financial power is an architecture of specific interlocking capacities held by different institutions. There are six distinct layers to this stack.
Okay, let's walk through these, but I want to really understand the mechanics of each one, not just the definition, but how they actually wield the power. What is layer one?
Layer one is monetary power.
Okay.
This is the raw capacity to create and expand purchasing power. As we discussed earlier, this is wielded by central banks creating reserves and commercial banks creating deposits through lending.
The balance sheet expansion.
Exactly. The mechanism here is literally typing money into existence.
So layer one mints the tokens, so to speak.
Yes.
Got it. What's layer two?
Layer two is allocative power. This is the authority to decide who actually receives that newly created credit and on what terms.
So who holds this power?
This is exercised by commercial bank loan officers, venture capital funds, government development banks. They set the underwriting standards.
They act as the gatekeepers.
Right. They decide if the solar farm gets a 3% interest rate and the local bakery gets a 9% rate or gets denied entirely.
So layer one creates the flow. Layer two points the hose.
That's a great way to put it.
What's layer three?
Layer three is valuation power.
Valuation.
This is incredibly subtle, but devastatingly powerful. It is the authority to determine what counts as an asset and precisely how much risk it carries.
And who does that?
This is the domain of credit rating agencies, major accounting firms, and benchmark index providers.
Wait, I'm struggling to see how an accounting firm or a rating agency wields sovereign power. They just publish opinions and spreadsheets, right? They aren't actually lending money.
They aren't lending, but their mathematical models dictate the cost of reality for everyone else.
Give me an example.
Let's go back to our island state after the hurricane. A rating agency uses a discounted cash flow model and assigns a sovereign risk premium to the island.
Okay.
If they tweak one variable in their algorithm, say they increase the perceived risk of future climate disasters, the island's credit rating drops from BBB to BB.
Just a change in a spreadsheet.
Right. But mechanically, this means institutional investors, like pension funds, whose bylaws legally forbid them from holding junk bonds, must instantly sell the island's debt.
Oh, wow. Which crashes the bond price and spikes the interest rate the island has to pay to borrow any money.
Precisely. And to afford the new, higher interest payments, the island's government must implement sudden austerity measures.
So real-world consequences.
Huge consequences. They fire teachers, they cut healthcare funding, they halt infrastructure repair. All this human suffering is triggered mechanically because a rating agency adjusted a risk variable in a spreadsheet in London or New York.
That is terrifyingly mechanical.
That is valuation power.
Okay. Layer four.
Layer four is disciplinary power.
Disciplinary sounds intense.
It is the capacity to induce behavioral adjustment through financial pain.
Like what?
It includes central banks raising macroeconomic interest rates to cool wage growth, or lenders issuing margin calls demanding more collateral, or the International Monetary Fund imposing structural adjustment conditions on a struggling nation in exchange for a loan.
So it is the mechanism of enforcing obedience to the credit constitution.
Exactly.
The punishment layer. If you step out of line, the operating system throttles your battery until you comply.
Yes.
Layer five.
Layer five is infrastructural power. This involves the physical and digital plumbing of the global economy.
The actual pipes.
Right. The clearinghouses, the settlement systems, the correspondent banking networks, and messaging systems like SWIFT.
Oh, right. SWIFT.
This is the power of access. If you are disconnected from this infrastructure, your money essentially ceases to exist internationally. You cannot clear a payment to buy oil or medicine.
We saw that heavily weaponized recently with geopolitical sanctions. If you get kicked off SWIFT, you are functionally exiled from the global economy.
You're completely cut off.
And the final layer.
Layer 6 is perhaps the most revealing, especially during a systemic crisis. Layer 6 is protective power.
Protective power.
This is the capacity of sovereign public institutions like central banks and treasuries to decide who gets rescued, who receives emergency liquidity, and who is allowed to fail and be liquidated.
So what does this all mean? If these layers are distributed across central banks, private banks, rating agencies, and Visa and MasterCard, isn't this really just administrative plumbing? Does the average person, you know, do you really need to care about clearing houses and swap lines?
Well, it might appear as neutral plumbing during times of stable economic expansion.
When everything's going fine.
Right. But Dr. Saley argues that in a crisis, the illusion of neutral plumbing shatters. Protective power reveals the moral and structural hierarchy of the system.
How does it reveal that?
When a massive shock hits, like the 2008 financial crisis or the global pandemic lockdowns, society suddenly discovers what this system truly values, because we see exactly who gets the lifeboat.
And who is at the top of that hierarchy?
The paper lays out a stark hierarchy of the protectable.
Hierarchy of the protectable. I like that phrase.
Sitting at the absolute apex, receiving instantaneous and mathematically unlimited rescue, are the core payment systems and the systemically important banks.
So the biggest players?
Yes.
Yes.
The central banks will create trillions in liquidity overnight to ensure these institutions do not collapse, because their failure would freeze the entire credit constitution.
They're literally too big to fail.
Exactly. Just beneath them are sovereign credit markets and major corporate asset markets. Central banks will step in as buyers of last resort to prevent these bond markets from cratering.
Okay, so the top is secure. What about the rest of us?
Well, as you move down the stack, the protection vanishes. Sitting at the very bottom, fully exposed to the disciplinary layer, are households, workers, local municipalities, and ecological systems.
Wow. So when a mega bank makes terrible bets and faces insolvency, the public balance sheet is deployed to save them because they are deemed structurally indispensable.
Right.
The operating system cannot let them die. But when a family loses their income due to a localized economic shock and defaults on their mortgage, they don't get a swap line from the central bank.
No, they certainly don't.
They get foreclosed on. They are treated as individually morally responsible, while the bank is treated as a systemic necessity.
The asymmetry is profound. The entire financial stack implicitly relies on public authority and social stability to function. But when a crisis arrives, the protective benefits of that public authority are overwhelmingly directed toward the top of the stack.
You know, when you lay it out like that, it feels incredibly coordinated.
It does feel that way.
I mean, if you are an average worker and you watch banks, governments, and rating agencies all moving in perfect lockstep to protect capital while your neighborhood is allowed to drown, it feels like a conspiracy.
Oh, absolutely.
The most natural human instinct is to assume there is a smoky back room in Davos where billionaires are sitting around a mahogany table, explicitly pulling levers and deciding who to crush. Is this a conspiracy?
It is the most persistent reflex we have when facing diffuse systemic harm. We want a villain with a face.
We want someone to blame.
And to be clear, the paper acknowledges that actual fraud, collusion, and corruption do exist and must be prosecuted.
Sure, bad actors exist.
But Dr. Saheeli's central argument is much more chilling. He says the financial system does not need a conspiracy to act like one. It operates through emergent coordination.
Emergent coordination, meaning these institutions are synchronizing without ever actually speaking to one another?
Yes.
How does that work in practice?
They coordinate because they are entirely bound by shared mathematical rules, shared risk models, and shared legal mandates.
Give me an example.
Okay, a commercial bank has a fiduciary mandate to optimize its return on equity. A pension fund has a legal mandate to hit an 8% benchmark return. A rating agency uses a standardized value-at-risk model to assess probability of default.
So they all have their specific rules.
Right. And when an economic indicator flashes red, they all react simultaneously, not because a secret council sent a memo, but because their internal legally binding algorithms tell them to execute the exact same maneuver.
Oh, I see. It's like a flock of starlings in a murmuration, you know, twisting and turning in the sky at the exact same millisecond.
Yes.
There isn't a CEO bird shouting orders over a tiny radio. Every single bird is just following three basic biological rules regarding spacing, alignment, and cohesion.
That is an excellent visualization of emergent behavior.
And in finance, those biological rules are profit mandates, benchmark tracking, and the absolute terror of exiting a bubble too late.
Exactly. The text deepens this by introducing the concept of epistemic synchronization.
Epistemic synchronization. Right. Okay.
Epistemology is the study of how we know things. Because these financial entities use the exact same data providers, the same accounting standards, and the same predictive models, they share a common field of vision.
They all look through the same lens.
But more dangerously, they share a common blindness.
Wait, how can highly sophisticated financial models be blind?
If a critical existential threat is not mathematically legible within their shared accounting frameworks, the entire system will collectively ignore it.
Like what kind of threat?
Take long-term ecological collapse or the gradual degradation of public health. Because these things do not easily translate into a quarterly risk metric or a discounted cash flow analysis, they don't exist to the operating system.
They just don't register.
Right. The institutions synchronize their ignorance. They can flawlessly execute a collective march off a cliff, acting completely rationally, according to their models, every step of the way.
They are literally incapable of perceiving the harm until it manifests as a financial loss on a balance sheet. And if we, as the public, don't understand that this is a blind structural machine, we fall into a really dangerous trap, don't we?
We do. The text issues a very stark, urgent warning here. When people feel the crushing, coordinated weight of this system, but lack the structural vocabulary to understand how it works, they reach for scapegoats.
Naturally.
Dr. Seth Healy explicitly highlights the historical and moral danger of collective scapegoating, particularly the rise of anti-Semitic tropes or vague, shadowy theories about globalists.
Right. Blaming a specific ethnic group or a secret society for the systemic outcomes of the credit constitution.
The author stresses that this kind of scapegoating is not only morally abhorrent and historically linked to catastrophic violence, but from a purely analytical perspective, it is a complete failure.
Why is it a failure?
Because it actively protects the financial architecture from being scrutinized or reformed.
Because you are letting the actual machine off the hook while you chase a phantom.
Precisely. If you believe the problem is simply evil people in a room, your solution will be to remove those people.
Right. Vote them out. Lock them up.
But if the problem is the fundamental rules of the credit constitution itself, the mandates, the valuation models, the protective hierarchies, then swapping out the individuals changes nothing.
The new guy will just do the same thing.
The machine will simply discipline the new operators until they act exactly like the old ones. You cannot fix a systemic algorithm by blaming a ghost.
That is a phenomenal point. The machine forces the behavior, which, you know, naturally leads to a historical question.
Let's hear it.
This massive, self-synchronizing, time-traveling machine didn't just drop out of the sky in the 21st century.
No, it took time to build.
Right. It wasn't invented in a weekend. Where did this invisible government actually begin?
To trace the origins of credit sovereignty, the text takes us far back in history, well before modern central banking or complex derivatives.
How far back?
It takes us to the pre-modern commercial networks, exploring what the paper calls the financing of distance.
The financing of distance. Paint the picture for us. What era are we talking about?
Imagine you were a merchant in Europe in the 1300s or 1400s. You have a massive, potentially fatal logistical problem.
Okay.
You want to buy silk or spices in one port city and sell them hundreds of miles away in another territory.
Makes sense. Trade.
But carrying heavy chests of gold and silver coins across fragmented, lawless political territories is incredibly dangerous.
Oh, sure. You'd get robbed.
You are vulnerable to pirates, highway bandits, and local rulers who might just arbitrarily confiscate your wealth. Furthermore, the physical money itself is chaotic. Different regions use different coins with varying weights and purities of precious metal.
It's an absolute nightmare.
It was.
If carrying the physical gold is basically a death sentence, or at least a massive liability, they must have needed a way to decouple the value from the physical metal itself. Did they just start writing IOUs to each other?
They developed something much more sophisticated than a simple IOU. To solve the merchant's dilemma, these networks invented one of the most revolutionary financial technologies in human history.
Which was?
The bill of exchange.
A bill of exchange. Let's break down the mechanics. How did it work?
It fundamentally separated the instruction to pay from the physical movement of money.
Okay.
A merchant could hand over physical goods or local coins to a trusted banking house in their home city. In return, they received a formalized piece of paper, the bill of exchange.
And what did the paper say?
This paper instructed a correspondent banking partner in the destination city to pay out the equivalent value in the local currency there at a specified future date.
Wait, if I'm a merchant in the 1400s, I can hand over a fortune in spices for a piece of paper, travel by ship for 2 months, and trust that a totally different banking family in a foreign city will honor it and hand me gold.
Yes.
How did that possibly function without a global legal system or, like, international police to enforce the contract?
It functioned through the creation of what the text calls portable reputation.
Portable reputation.
Because there was no overarching sovereign court to enforce international commercial law, creditworthiness became a highly formalized, socially produced form of identity.
So it was all about who you knew and what your name meant.
Exactly. A merchant house's name, their historical track record of settling debts, and the network of guarantors who vouched for them, that reputation became an asset as tangible as gold.
Wow.
If a merchant or a banker defaulted on a bill of exchange, they were instantly exiled from the network. They could never trade again. The threat of social and commercial death enforced the financial promise.
So trust literally became a tradable asset.
It did.
But wait, if I hold that piece of paper and it says I get paid in 3 months, but I need cash right now to buy more goods for my next voyage, I'm stuck.
Not for long, because that exact friction led to the next massive evolutionary leap.
Oh, what's that?
The invention of negotiability. Merchants realized they didn't have to passively hold the bill until maturity.
What did they do?
If a bill promised 100 gold coins in 3 months, I could sell that piece of paper to a third party today for, say, 95 gold coins.
Because the third party is willing to take a 5-coin profit in exchange for waiting 3 months and taking on the risk. The future obligation suddenly acquires a present-day price.
Yes. This is the moment the financial claim detaches from the underlying physical transaction of silk or spices and takes on a life of its own.
It becomes its own thing.
It becomes a freely circulating instrument of value. Finance began to construct a secondary, abstract field of value running parallel to the physical economy.
The paper itself became a form of money.
This was the genesis of the credit constitution. It's the exact moment when abstract promises about the future began to govern the allocation of resources in the present.
And if we fast forward a few centuries, those circulating pieces of paper have evolved into algorithmic derivatives, sovereign bond markets, and a complex financial power stack that decides whether a hurricane-ravaged island gets to rebuild its hospitals.
It's an incredible direct line from the 1400s to today.
It is an incredible, albeit slightly terrifying, evolution. And, you know, we have covered an immense amount of ground today.
We really have.
We've explored the illusion of political sovereignty during a crisis, unpacked the time-traveling nature of organized anticipation, dismantled the passive intermediation myth.
The loanable funds myth, right?
We've mapped the 6 layers of the power stack, dispelled the smoky room conspiracy in favor of emergent coordination, and traced the roots back to medieval merchants trying to survive pirates.
It provides a truly necessary structural lens for viewing the world.
It does. And I want to synthesize the ultimate takeaway from Dr. Safely's text, because it is important to note that the paper does not argue that credit itself is inherently evil or must be abolished.
No, not at all.
Without credit, without the ability to organize anticipation, we wouldn't have modern civilization.
Yeah.
We couldn't build transcontinental infrastructure or fund massive public health initiatives or coordinate complex projects across generations. The crucial defining distinction the author makes is between what he terms life credit and dead claims.
That distinction is the moral center of the entire analysis.
Life credit is finance that explicitly serves the living world. It finances activities that restore, maintain, or enlarge the capacities of human beings and ecological systems to thrive.
Like what?
Like, it builds resilient public housing, it funds renewable energy grids, it enables regenerative agriculture. The defining feature of life credit is that the future actually receives more structural capacity than the financial claim extracts in debt service.
The living reality expands.
Right. But on the opposing side, you have dead claims.
The dark side of it.
These are financial entitlements that are ruthlessly preserved by the operating system long after their life-serving purpose has vanished.
Any example of that?
It's when a community's public transit system is bled dry and stripped of maintenance just to pay a compounding debt to a private equity firm.
Right.
Or when a rainforest is clear-cut merely to maintain a quarterly dividend yield. It is when humanity and nature are forcibly adjusted to serve the debt, rather than the debt adjusting to the reality of human life.
It's when the derivative claim is more highly protected than the living reality from which it was derived.
It is the ultimate inversion of purpose. The tool becomes the master.
Absolutely. Beautifully said.
So when you look at your own mortgage statement this month, or when you read a headline that the central bank is raising interest rates, or when you see your local municipality cancel a vital infrastructure project to meet a fiscal target, do not just see it as random economic weather.
It's not random.
You are witnessing the credit constitution in action. The future is actively being written by these mechanisms. And the ultimate question Dr. Sterley poses is whether society will wake up, recognize the operating system for what it is, and democratize who gets to author that future.
It is the defining question of political economy for the 21st century.
It absolutely is. And as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final provocative thought to mull over. We touched earlier on the idea that this system operates blindly, following its own internal logic.
Right, emergent coordination.
And the text uses a fascinating term for this, financial autopoietization.
It's a biological term.
It is. It means a system that is capable of reproducing and maintaining itself. Now, think about it like this. We spend so much time today agonizing over the impending arrival of artificial intelligence.
Oh, constantly.
We fear this sci-fi singularity moment when a super intelligent machine optimizing for its own obscure mathematical goals might suddenly decide it doesn't need humanity.
It'll just wipe us out to make paperclips.
Exactly. We worry that the AI will view human life and ecological stability merely as obstacles to its own optimization process.
Yeah.
But looking closely at the mechanics of the credit constitution, at this self-synchronizing network of rating agencies, yield curves, and algorithms, you have to wonder.
Wonder why.
What if the singularity actually happened centuries ago?
Oh, well.
What if the global financial system, with its self-reinforcing codes of compounding interest, algorithmic risk modeling, and leverage, is essentially the first autonomous, non-human superintelligence we ever built?
That is a terrifying thought.
It is a system optimizing purely for its own survival and expansion, happily consuming the living biological world merely as an input on its sprawling balance sheet.
Wow.
So the real question isn't whether the machines will eventually take over. The question is whether we can ever take the controls back from the machine we already live inside.